Hi, welcome to Pathways. This is the podcast where we speak with Grenadians and other West Indians pursuing careers in the STEAM fields. Today's discussion is going to be another interesting one, so stick around. We hope you find something that resonates and helps keep you going along your journey. Today, I'm speaking with Julian Mitchell. Julian is quite possibly a household name for some in the fields of residential architectural design and boundary-pushing photography. Born and raised in Grenada, he quite literally fled to the United States after secondary school in pursuit of larger dreams, and eventually returned years later to shake things up on the architecture scene at home. This guy is quite the polymath, and so our conversations are always interesting and sure to leave you with something to ponder. I hope you enjoy the discussion as we learn more about Julian's pathway. All right, Julian Mitchell, sir, welcome to Pathways, the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right, so most people, I think, might know you as Creative Doc. I don't know if you still go by that name.
I have many names, but that's one of them, yes.
Right. So I've been looking forward to this conversation, and I don't know where it's going to go because I feel like we could take a few different directions.
Yes.
But in my mind, you're a man of many talents, many different pursuits, and I can't even keep up with all the different things that you getting into sometimes. So I'm going to let you define it. So when somebody asks you, what do you do? What's your response?
Most times I ask them to identify what they mean when they say, what do I do? Because I don't know how to answer the question. Because I could answer the question volunteering more than they require. So I would always ask for context in responding to the question, like, what do you mean? What do I do? And I just say I'm a multidisciplined human being. That's my normal answer when I want to be vague. Multidisciplined human being.
Okay. And so if I asked, what do you do for a living? What's your career path in life?
What do I do? What do I do to earn money? Then that too. So there is the architecture fabrication. I want to say entrepreneurial spirit because I venture into different business type once an opportunity presents itself. I am there. But mostly things that are in the create realm where you create things from ideas. From raw materials, that is where I have a tendency to find myself and to earn a living. These days it has been fishing. So
fishing. Okay. Is that just a hobby or is that more of a business pursuit for you?
Well, it started out as a hobby and now it turns into a business. So I'm going to enjoy the fishing while I can. So go out and fish and catch more fish than I need and sell it.
Okay.
So most people, you know, you get fresh fish, you get it within 24 to 48 hours. So now people call, they make a request. Okay, I need 2 pounds, I need 3 pounds, I need whatever. And I just go get it.
All right. Like I said, a man of many different pursuits. Okay. So let's take it back a little bit. And this might seem like a strange question, but could you describe yourself in your primary and secondary school years? What type of young students were you?
A harder one. In that I didn't like school. Didn't really see the purpose. And I always felt as if I was just forced to go to school. I didn't want to go to school. I couldn't see the point of what, because I was more interested in things that was, you know, outdoors and things that you can feel and like were very tactile. And going to read a book about history, about stuff that's already passed, that didn't really appeal to me. It's good to know. I get it, but how does that help me now? So I didn't really care for it. But I just went through the motions of, this is what you have to do in your parents' home. So you follow the instructions that you're given because you don't know better. So that was the primary school years. The secondary school years, you know, you get a little, I got a little bit more knowledge and able to understand myself a little bit better. And that is when pretty much the rebellion started, where I definitely didn't want to go to school. I wasn't a very, someone that was into reading and books, and I still don't, but I read only out of necessity. But I didn't really care for it. So, going to secondary school is just always last in the class. I don't even think I ever come above the last 10 ever. So I didn't have much of that, scholastic aptitude for classroom work. So that was it. And then the first distraction that popped up was sports. So I gravitated to that because it meant not having to really be in the classroom.
So you were an athlete?
Yes.
What did you play?
I did the javelin, discus, and shot put when I went to secondary school, then played a little football. So any sport that I could have played that took me away from the classroom, I gravitated to it immediately. Okay. If they played netball, I would have definitely done that too.
Tough guy. I could see it. Okay, so in all of this, you know, you're in school, but you don't really want to be in school. When did you realize, because I'm assuming that architecture was kind of what you first started to get into. When did you realize that's what you want to do?
Well, it was twofold. They used to have a guy that, you know, walked around Grenada that were friends with my father. It's an English guy. But he drank a lot, so he was always drunk. But he would always sketch on napkins, right? He was an architect in England. Don't know how we end up in Grenada, but he did. And he used to sketch on napkins. And I used to follow this guy because I was just so amazed, how is he drawing this stuff on the napkin? And just freehand, just like this. So I used to follow him every chance I get. Wherever I see him, I would go and engage him, you know, to try to watch him do it. I used to walk with napkins so I could give it to him so that he can draw stuff, just so I could look at it. And while I think I was in form two or form three, GBS has introduced technical drawing. And that for me was, again, to escape the classroom, because you had to go to a lab. It was not in the class. And the walk from the classroom to the lab was, well, 3-4 minutes. So I used to delay the process as long as I could, so I didn't have to get back in the classroom as fast. So me ending up into the technical drawing class was as a means of getting away from the classroom.
Wow.
So it wasn't the intent of wanting to be in the technical drawing. It was trying to get away from the classroom. But at the same time, I just can't remember the gentleman's name. But in seeing this guy sketching and knowing, okay, you know, he's talking about the technical drawing, I started to gravitate towards it. Because if I wanted to be like him, then I had to do this. So I gravitated to it more.
Okay, so what happened next? You did TDM, guessing, all the way through CXE, and then
right. So I did. I started to take it more seriously, and you know, I even forgot the teacher's name, but I took it like extra seriously, where I pretty much finished the school curriculum. He allowed me, without telling everyone, allowed me to progress further than the curriculum. So I pretty much finished the curriculum all the way up to fifth form while I was in form three. Never told anyone. He never told anyone. I never told anyone. So everyone was kind of curious as to why is it I'm flying through the whole thing. Because I did it every day, like every single day. I would do that only I'm in the back they're teaching English B or whatever it is, and I'm in the back there sketching, just trying to stay ahead of the class. So, because I just didn't care for English B, I'm not going to be, what I care about Shakespeare, he's dead. So that's what I did. And it's funny enough, I sat 7 subjects for CXC, only passed 2.
Only passed 2?
Only subject I passed is 2.
Oh, okay.
Technical drawing is one of them. And I can't remember where the next one is because I've never actually seen the paper that said pass. So because I didn't care for it. I didn't care what it said.
You were done with school and you washed your hands.
Yeah. So I didn't really care what the results were because for me, the results wasn't going to define what I had in mind to do. Mm-hmm. So all I know, I passed technical drawing and that's the only thing I cared about. I was very happy about that. So all my friends who had 6 and 7 passes, I'm like, okay, great for you. I get the one I care about, this one. So that was that. But then at the same time, I didn't want to stay in Grenada either. I just felt Grenada was, a little backstory is my brother and I used to travel every year. We would, you know, travel to different parts of the world. Parents will take us to different parts of the world. So we were introduced to the world at an early age.
Okay.
So we've seen things and we've known things. So being in Grenada, when you have people telling you that certain things are can't be done and it's difficult and you're traveling at a young age and you're seeing it and it seems so easy, didn't make sense.
What so, kind of places did you travel to?
Well, we traveled to most of the continental United States, not continental United States, but most of the United States, Florida, then we went to Puerto Rico, came up the Caribbean Islands, then we went to New York, Germany. Those were the places that we got to go at the early ages.
Okay.
So just being able to see what was there at that time and then coming back to a small island and then trying to figure out, well, why we can't do it? Like, what's the reason? And to me, the reasons that I heard just didn't make sense to me that I'm watching, you know, kids my age doing things I can't even fathom. So I was like, well, why? So I developed throughout the whole secondary school year, not wanting to be in Grenada at all. I just felt as if I was going to die if I stay there. I was just going to end up, at the time they used to call it travel or cleaning drains. So I'm like, that's what I'm going to end up doing. And the culture at the time was, if you didn't pass X amount of subjects, your life is over.
Yep.
You know, you're not going to amount to anything. That was the pressure that was put on, you know, students. And I did not agree with that. So by all means necessary, I needed to get out.
Okay. So you are a man on a mission.
Yeah. To get out.
And do more with your life.
Yeah.
And so what took you to New York?
Time and patience. So my mom used to give me $5 to go to school. And this is something that most people will never know, but now they're going to hear it. She used to give me $5 to go to school. So for 5 years, I used to save $2.50. And I used to hide it outside so my brother don't see under a plum tree. We used to have a plum tree in the yard. So I used to dig a hole and put the money in there. And I saved $2.50 every day for 5 years. And that is what I used to buy my plane ticket. When I left Grenada the day when we were supposed to have a graduation party.
Uh-huh.
Didn't tell anyone. I just left. Not a soul. I just left. And nobody seen me since.
Wow.
So for some, it's like, I just disappear off the face of the planet. I had no communications with, I just wanted to go by all means necessary, cost it what it will. I needed to go. So I was willing, I was prepared to give up everything and just go. As long as I wasn't there and I was here, I felt I had a fighting chance.
Always a rebel. Okay, that's news to me.
We'll never know that. They'll never know that part.
Yeah, you're just expressing all your childhood secrets here now. Okay, so you end up in New York, and what's next? Are you on the path to being an architect? Do you end up going
Like anyone who comes to New York for the first time, you know, when you get your hair, you get to hit with the glitz and the glamour of, it's not what it's all meant to be. You know, it looks pretty on the TV, and, you know, so at the time, my dad was still here, and as soon as I got here, you know, the realization of, oh, now you're here. Oh, I'm going back. Like, what? So he left and went back, and I was left there by myself. Wow. Which I was happy with, because I felt like I was emancipated. It was free. I didn't have a parent around me to watch me and tell me anything. I'm free to do whatever the hell I wanted to do, which was good. So it allowed me to not have that, you know, as for me, looking back in hindsight and current thinking, parents are there to provide guidance, right? And to protect you, but their protection comes at a price. And the price it comes with is sometimes lack of progress, because their fears can be instilled in you to prevent you from doing something that you are better equipped to do than they are. And they don't get to see that, because their love is shrouded in protection. So when I was in Grenada, I was shrouded with that, and I didn't do much. When I was here and I didn't have that, I did everything. So that gave me the confidence that I needed to not be fearful of things that I would otherwise be afraid of, like taking chances, taking risks. Even today, my mother still says to me, walk on the side, don't go to crowds. And I say to her, none of the advice that you have given me, I listen to, so you could stop giving it to me. Because I don't listen to you. I'm not going to listen to you. It has no relevance in anything that I'm doing. But she still gives it. Okay. But I keep telling her, I don't need it. So I came here, and then I wanted to go to school. So trying to figure out how to go to school, but then needed to get a job. So I started to work in construction, which I got to piggyback off, because my father was in construction at the time. And I get to piggyback a little bit off of some of the contacts that he had. So my first job was, like everyone else, was a laborer, you know, get to carry the blocks, mix the cement, and the hard work, the real hard work. You come home and you just don't want to. Yeah. So I did that. And I remember one day being in a site, and it was a Jewish architect, and he came to the site, and I'm just watching him making all the little demands. No, I don't want this. Yes. No, take this down. And it brought back that this is what I want to do. But being in New York, and you know, you have to survive, you kind of lose track of where you were trying to go, but that was the reminder that I needed. So I said, okay, time to go to school. Well, trying to find a school. Now, this is where the Grenada part pops back in. It could be a problematic situation. So I'm trying to find a school, and the school says, well, where's your transcript? Where's my what? Transcript. Do I need that? Yes, you do. So they're like, okay. So now, I have to go back to GBSS now, when I thought I'm done with them, to get the transcript. Well, that turned out to be a little bit of a nightmare, because they're trying to get the transcript. I can't get the transcript. It's just taken back and forth. They're moving very slow. At the time, it's fax machine, and you got emails like that. So it's like, to fax it over, it just took too long. So at the time, all the schools I was trying to apply to, I could not get in. Could not get in, because it just wasn't happening for me. So there was one day I'm sitting at home, and they're advertising this school in New Jersey. At the time, it was called Lincoln Technical Institute. So I'm like, okay. So I decide I'm going to go there. So I called them up, made an appointment, went and sat with a lady, and she's like, where's your transcript? Are you an international student? I'm like, what? So she's like, yes, you have to be an international student, and you need to have the funds allocated for X amount of semesters there. I'm like, what? Roadblock. I'm like, damn it. This is not easy. So I'm like, okay. So I said, I'll get back to you. So I left, and I'm trying to ponder how to get it done. by that time, my father is back. I'm like, okay, we need X amount of money. And he's like, son, I don't got it. I'm like, what? Okay. He's like, you know, I could do this. So my father put as much as he can do. I guess he borrowed from whoever he need to borrow from. And they put together, but it wasn't enough. So I'm like, well, I guess I just have to work to get it done. So I never wanted to get into the whole student loan things because everyone who gets student loan turned out to be a nightmare afterwards. So I'm like, I don't want to do the student loan thing. So I went back to the lady and I got there 6 o'clock in the morning because I overheard her saying she gets to work at 6. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to try to catch her early. Maybe I could have a conversation with her and see what she can do for me. So I got there early, waited outside her office, and she showed up, walked up to her and explained to her. She's like, you know what? I like you. Come. And she sat down in the office, and she said what she was going to do to get me in. Can't really say what it is. But she said what she was going to do to get me in, and there are a certain set of procedures I need to follow in order for this it to work. No problem. So she did what she had to do, followed a set of procedures, and I got in, like everybody else. And I just had to keep quiet about certain things, which I did. And I got able to get to school. I went to school and, again, graduated from there. And when I graduated from there, the day of my graduation, the graduation day itself, I could not make the graduation day. So to go pick up your degree, they was going to send it to you. I'm like, I want to come and pick it up. No, we're going to send it to you. So all the classmates, everyone, we decided we're going to have one day at the school, you know, just to, you know, just have a little party. And I decided, okay, I'm going to go to this one. And on the way back, the school was in New Jersey. One of my classmates said, could you drop off this letter at an office in Brooklyn for me? I'm like, sure. Now, what I didn't know is his resume was in the letter. So I'm like, okay, it's not far from where I live. I'll drop it off. I go to the office to drop off the resume. And when I get to the office, it was an architectural office. The name of the office was Robert L. Henry Architects, you know, prominent black architect. And there was a guy sitting on the computer doing some work on AutoCAD. And while I'm waiting, I'm watching him because, you know, it's like all fascinating stuff to me. I'm in an architectural office. It's all like candy store stuff. And I decided when I'm walking past him, because the secretary told me, you know, go into that room and drop off the letter to who I have to drop it off to. And when I walked past him, I said to him, if you do this, you know, you could save yourself 20 minutes. And he's like, yeah. And he's like, yeah. So he did it and realized, man, you know, I've been doing this for years and you just saved me 20 minutes. I'm like, yeah. So I said, okay. And I walk and I continue on and I dropped off the letter to one of the principals of the company and I'm walking back out. When I'm walking back out, he stops me and he's like, do you want a job? I'm like, yeah. He's like, okay. When do you start? Whenever you tell me. He's like, start you on Monday. I say, okay. He's like, what are you looking for? Pay? I said, I don't know. He's like, how about we give you $400 a week? I'm like, okay. And that is how I started working. Literally, that's how I started working. That was my first job in architecture the day after my graduation. No resume ever. Never typed a resume. To this day, I've never typed a resume.
Julian. This is going even in a more interesting direction than I thought. All right, so back up a little bit. You went to school, LTI?
Lincoln Tech.
For architecture, what was your major?
Yes, it was architecture.
Okay. Was it a 4-year program, 5-year?
It was 4, so it was a bachelor's.
Okay, 4-year
bachelor's. Because they eliminated some of the crap stuff, the shit you don't need.
Okay. So what was the experience there? Was it any different from school in Grenada where you didn't want to be?
Oh, yeah. Because I wanted to be there, right. You know, I eat up everything. So I definitely wanted to be there because it was something that I wanted to do. And that to me, that was a stepping stone into getting it. At moments, I didn't want to go because the school was in New Jersey and I had to leave from Brooklyn 6 o'clock in the morning to get there for 8 o'clock. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of a pain, but I enjoyed the most part of it. Unfortunately, all of the people I went to school with, I have no connection to them today, but it was definitely a fun experience. Like there, I had no horrible moments about, going to the school. Nah, I had none of that. Everything about it was pretty good. So it was a great experience.
Okay. All right. So you're in this new job now. What was that starting off? What did you work on?
Well, when you leave, architecture school, you believe that once you get into the job, you're going to do fancy smancy. You're going to do things that are just going to change the world.
That's not how it works.
Apparently, that's not how it works. Right? So the firm that I worked in, they did a lot of residential homes, commercial, and then they had, because it was a black-owned business, they were part of a bigger firm that was called BBG, right? Behrman, Behrman, Goodman, Moss, which at the time was the number two architectural firm in the entire New York City area. And they were going to be in the world. So part of the, when you have certain projects of a certain size, you need to have a minority business. So the minority business used to be the firm that I work with. So in that time, there are a couple of projects that I got to be a part of through being in that firm, but we were not the principal architects on the project. So one was the JFK terminal that's there right now. So that was something I got to work on doing bathrooms. So I know those bathrooms pretty good, pretty good. Because all I did all day was bathrooms, tweak bathrooms, make sure bathrooms was ADA compliant, making sure that the door, pretty much my job at the time was to make sure everything to do with bathrooms and all the bathrooms in the facilities were ADA compliant and to make sure we're not violating any rules and so on and so forth. That was that. Then you had Carnegie Towers. So you have Carnegie Hall and then there's Carnegie Towers. So Carnegie Towers is the largest brick structure in New York City. So get to work on that too. But for the most part, predominantly in the office, it was residential homes, conversions, legalization. People come with violations, lots of restaurants. That's why I have a lot of restaurants today. And every now and then you'll get something that's, you know, a condo renovation or a high-end apartment. You'll get, but very rare, if ever, did we get to do something of that was like $50, $60 million from scratch. We didn't get those. So it was really the grassroots bottom. I don't want to say the bottom of the barrel. That's wrong, right? But you get the, what would seem like the non-glitzy stuff. The stuff that, you know, as a big architect would say, nah, I ain't got time for that. But that's what I got to do day to day in terms of, you know, that. I didn't get to interact with clients. I had no conversation with clients, you know.
Right. None of it. So that was my next question. Were you strictly just in front of your computer, you know, drafting up toilets, or did you get go onto the site, see what was happening?
I had two bosses. One was Landis Dooley was one, and the other one was Robert Henry. So both of them are, the dynamics of them were great, right? But there's two different peas in a pod. There are two different individuals. One was from Jamaica, one was from Trinidad. One was more quiet, one is more, have more of a character, a character kind of guy, right? But combined, they're a powerful force, right? But Mr. Henry, which was the one from Trinidad, we gravitated to each other more because Mr. Henry used to, not do the client's projects on time. So a client would come in, he'd sit down, you know, say, okay, you know, he'd have whatever conversation he had with them. And he said, okay, you know what? I'm ready. I'll come back in 2 weeks. You know, can we have something for you? And then 2 weeks would come and he forgot. So the client was like, okay, I'm coming to your office tomorrow. Are we good? And he's like, yeah, we're good. Everything is ready for you. So then he would come to me and say, Julian, we need to bang something out quickly. So over the years of doing that, myself and him developed the relationship where we would wait. He would wait till the last minute, a day, 24 hours, a couple hours, before the client reached to come and say to me, do this, do this, do this, do this, do this, do this. And I would have to develop a set of plans by taking an existing plan, modifying it to suit the needs of what we need to do, so that when the client comes, we have something to present. It's not a good habit to do. But what it did do for me was develop speed. So I had to think really fast to be able to present this drawing, this design, as an original drawing, making sure no part of it existed from the other part, as if it was sitting there for 2 weeks. So although it was a bad practice to do, we don't recommend anybody do it, but I know many offices that still do it.
Yeah.
It developed me to be able to design and draw fast by being able to think very quickly to solve certain scenarios, because you have a client ready to come in, too ready to shoot you because you're not doing their stuff and they paid you their money and they need their stuff done. It's a dire situation. So that, although it's a bad situation in the sense, turned out to be a good thing in the long run.
This is all coming together and starting to make sense to me about the person you are today. Very interesting series of events. All right, so Julian, when we first met, I was in Tampa, D.C.
Yes.
And you came in, this random guy, trying to teach us Revit.
Mm-hmm.
That's my memory of how we first met.
Yes.
So between this, what was the timeline between like you getting your first job and you then coming back to Grenada, the place you wanted to escape to see, let's see what's happening here?
A matter of fact, that year that you met me, which I believe was 2011,
mm-hmm.
And the reason why I think it's 2011 is because that was the first time I came back to Grenada since leaving in 1999.
Wow.
Right? And the reason, even when I came back, my mother didn't recognize me. She never seen me. From the time I left, there was no photos, there's no evidence. Cease and desist means cease and desist. No one seen me from that time. So me coming back, I've never been to TAMCC, but I was always curious as to what happens there. So I went up to GBSS to see what it looked like because, you know, after that much time, I was expecting, ooh, the place has changed. Only to come back and realize it's the exact same thing. Like, where's the progress? So I didn't see any change. So I was like, well, okay, let me go to TAMCC. Let me see what they have. And it looked the exact same way. And I remember walking in, and I think you guys were in a somewhat of a classroom setting area. And I asked the question, who among you are considered like the best designer, best? And I remember they pointing to someone in the corner. I think his name was Kareem. Was it Kareem? No, it was Gilbert. I know his last name was Gilbert. I know it was Gilbert. I remember that one.
Ryden.
Yes, it was Ryden. And I think the guy said the teacher, he had a design, and the teacher told him that a dog is going to sleep in that corner. And I was so mad when I heard that because I wanted to go confront the teacher. I didn't know you guys. I just met it. But the mere fact that you said that when you guys are in a state of learning, right? Part of architecture is criticism. You're going to be criticized and you got to take it. But at the stage that you guys were in, not knowing what you're doing, you can't criticize. You got to criticize if you know what you're doing. So I was like, okay. And I remember, you know, going through, you know, just trying to ask questions to see, well, what are you guys learning? And it, for me, it's like, they're not learning shit. So why are they here? So that's when I remember asking the question, you know, what software you guys are using, what, and I made the decision in that moment just to ask you guys, if I were to come back and set up a class, would you guys be interested? So I remember taking everybody's email and everybody's whoever email and contact information. And I think the main contact person at the time was Audric. Using Audric to you know, kind of round it up altogether. Okay. And I said, okay, I'm going to teach a class, and whoever wants to come, it's free of charge. And even that was a challenge, because when I reached out to Tam Cici, they gave me the runaround. I met with one of the faculty members. I'm not going to call her name, but we know who it is. And I couldn't get, all I wanted was a space. All I was asking for, I wasn't asking you to spend a dollar. Just give me a space where I can have your students sit and be edified. Couldn't get it. So that was a dead. One of the students did like a part-time job at the museum, like where the museum is at the Carinage area there.
Right.
They offered the space because they heard what I was doing, and they offered the space. It's like, okay, you can use the space. You know, we have AC, and they allowed me to use the space. And that's where we had the little mini classes.
Yep, I remember this.
Yeah, so that's how it ended up being there, because they offered the space, and, you know, I opened the door to everyone. I still have videos of it. I think I have to find videos and pictures of the classroom setting and everyone sitting there. And, you know, the turnout was great. I was kind of surprised that everybody, the amount of person that showed up, but it showed that there was an interest. Mm-hmm. You know? And I always say to someone, I said to someone recently, I said, it's funny. I think there were maybe 11 or 12 initially. But in total, it was a total of 15. In total, of all the days, it was 15. But out of the 15 is you, Ryden, there's someone else, there's a third person who actually pursued and went down, not exactly, but in the field in some way, shape, or form. Because I think Ryden just graduated, right?
I haven't been in touch. I don't know.
You're bad. I understand, trust me. So I think he recently graduated with a degree. I don't know if it was Morocco or Sweden or wherever he graduated, but because I was looking at his thesis. So that's that whole Grenada saga coming back there.
Right. So if I remember correctly, I don't think that was your main reason for coming to Grenada. What brought you back? You wanted to get into the industry, start seeing what design was looking like in Grenada?
Well, when we met, it was just for coming back sake, right? Okay. When we met. Then a couple of years afterwards, because I had no desire to do anything in Grenada at all. Zero, zilch, none. But I was just curious as to where the architecture has gone to, only to realize it's the same thing. And it just couldn't dawn on me that after all these years, why is the thinking like nothing changed? Why is it, are we so grounded in tradition that we refuse to move and then we're going to get left behind whether we like it or not? So a couple of years later, I think 2000 and don't remember, I'll have to look it up. My friend reached out to me about doing a bowling alley.
Okay.
Right. Huh? So the bowling alley is what initially triggered it. But before the bowling alley, I had for someone that I met, and I was a really good friend, Teddy, right? Photographer, creative guy. You know, we hang out a lot and we talked a lot about photography, because most of the trips to Grenada prior to LAVO was photography. It's all photography. Just pushing the photography, you know, getting people. At that time, Grenada only had maybe two photographers that were willing to do anything outside the box. You didn't have the Damians, you didn't have the Dwayne's. They weren't there yet. Mm-hmm. But he was there, you know, pushing, trying different things, you know, wanting to be in a creative sense. So, and that's what Dwayne was there. And when the opportunity presented itself to do an architectural project, I wasn't really for it, to be honest. I wasn't, like, I didn't want to do anything in Grenada. No, my language was, they're backward. That's what I said. And I'm like, no, it's like you have to fight with them for progress. Like, I don't have the time to deal with it. But the owner of LAVO, he was adamant about doing it. Sure. And I was like, okay, all right, fine. We going to do this. So set out on the journey to put up this building. And I was like, okay, never did a bowling alley before, so this could be interesting. So, you know, do the necessary research, you know, do the groundwork, understand what, you know, do a lot of case studies, look at case studies of other bowling alleys, visit hundreds of bowling alleys, you know, take what works, speak to some of the owners and the and managers and the companies from the different, you know, the pros and the cons and so on, and then try to put something together that marries Caribbean in a little way, but not so much. And that is how that project was born. And then from that point on, Grenada turned into a place, a location that I can practice.
So, backtrack a little bit. You were visiting different bowling alleys trying to figure out how this works because you never designed anything like that before.
Correct.
Were those mostly in New York, or how far did your precedent research extend?
Well, in most cases was myself and the owner that went, because he obviously didn't build a bowling alley before either, so he had to understand some of the finances and logistics involved. So we visited bowling alleys that were between New York and New Jersey, because between New York and New Jersey, with the exception of Vegas, they are the highest grossing bowling alleys in the entire United States of America.
Did not know that. Okay.
Right. So the highest grossing bowling alley in the United States of America is right there in Manhattan and Chelsea Pier. Can't disclose how much it is, but it's significant. Right. So their model is what a lot of other bowling alleys will try to mimic in order to get it. So we went and we visited the top tier based on the manufacturers and gross to see what was working for them. Not to say that Grenada is the exact business model, but for me, it was more so, okay, what are they offering? What's the ambience? What's the setting? And then you get to speak to the owners of, you know, things that they would have done differently had they do it over now that it's built to avoid those pitfalls in this building. So that's where our reach went.
Okay. And so just briefly, what was that process like, you know, compiling all this information and knowledge and then putting it into a building in Grenada where we've never had in my lifetime, which is a short one, but we've never had a bowling alley of that caliber, let's say, before?
Well, it was definitely a challenge, yeah, because, you know, some of the individuals that were privy to the project were like, why are you putting that there? And why are you trying to put this there, you know, to lessen on what we were originally going to put in? There are a lot of things more we were going to put in that didn't get to make the final cut. But we were able to take the best of the best within the budget and compile the yeses and the no's. So we had a list of yeses and no's. These are things that we have to hit in terms of these different design criteria. And then two, one of the main thing was to design the building based on IBC, right? I know Grenada and the Caribbean has this building code, but we figured let's make it a little bit more stricter. International Building Code.
International Building Code. Okay.
So the building was built utilizing IBC and my knowledge of New York City Building Code. So if we were to take that building and drop it in New York City, with the exceptions of sprinkler, it would pass in flying colors. It would fit right in with no problems.
Okay. So you weren't adhering to Grenada's building codes, but you wanted to go above and beyond, make sure they were international standards.
Correct. Because one of the points that we were hitting was to have international bowling competitions, because bowling is the only sport in the world that everyone can play. Mm. You don't require any physical ability to play bowling. If you've never seen a celebrity football match, but their celebrity bowling match. Most celebrities might put a bowling alley in a house, but not a football field. So as much as bowling is second to football in terms of the most watched, but the most played is bowling because it requires no skill.
And well, some may beg to differ on that, but I see.
You see, you have to look at it first. To play football.
If you're just
basing it on kicking a ball, mm-hmm. then football wins, hands down.
Right.
Let me become political. Soccer, football, right? But if you're basing it on an organized sport that you can go and play, bowling wins. Because you can play football in your yard, in the street, anywhere. But if you have to organize to go play, bowling will. Because again, as I said, it's based on the premise that you don't need any skill to play. Technically same for football. I don't need any skill. But the two of them are competing. Subjective, yes. Because if I were to go to some parts of the world, if I were to take the Caribbean as a whole, mm-hmm. they don't know anything about bowling as a whole, but they do know something about football.
And you can kick the ball anywhere.
And right. kick the ball anyway. So is it subjective? Yes.
Okay. All right. So you went through the whole process, developed, you know, what is today Lavo Lanes. And how did you feel about the final result at the end of the day?
The final result is most times very rare you're going to find, you know, an architect that's going to be 100% happy with final results, because there's always something that you wanted in there that didn't get to make the final cut.
Mm-hmm.
But taking into consideration all of the challenges, I'm 90% okay with the final results. Not 100%. Because for me, there are a couple of things that I'd have liked to see a little better, right? But mm-hmm. I can't have it all the way all the time. I mean, even here, practicing in New York also, I still can't get, even though we have the skilled individuals, you have the material, you have this, it doesn't always work out that way all the time. You know, sometimes in construction and the process, things come up that just finances, logistics, interferences, things you can't touch, rules, regulation, that just prevents you from getting certain things that you just have to say okay to. And that was the situation there.
Okay. That makes perfect sense. And you know, something I didn't realize that you had that background in construction, but it makes so much sense because what I've seen of your design process and thinking is really all about how the pieces come together. Mm-hmm.
That is the beautiful part, is that I worked in construction first.
Right.
So anything that for me in designing and putting a concept or a form together, I know I can build it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I know the connections. You know, so it's not just me just, you know, looking at something on a drawing, and I can articulate how to put it together and I can get hands on.
Right.
So it solves it. You know, most times as in architecture, you try not to think about too much of the finished product when you're in the concept phases of the project.
Mm-hmm.
But because of my experiences and some of the things that I have to go through, I end up thinking of everything holistically in that. I'm thinking of the structure. I'm thinking of this. I'm thinking of in the early concept phases, like, oh, this is not going to work because I don't want to put this concept together and then have to spend X amount of time with an engineer trying to figure out how to get it to work. So I'm thinking about the limitations and the ease of it early. So, yeah.
And that's something I think a lot of architects would benefit from. I'm working in the construction industry now, and you see some, you know, designs or details come from architecture offices, and you're like, how is this supposed to work? You know,
oh, I get it all the time, right? I get it all the time. We work with other architects also. And you know, you have even contractors that are trying to do something and you're looking at them like, did you think about what you're asking or what you're proposing? Like, do you really think about it? And in some cases, you know, you put it together, but you're not thinking how, because they might have taken it from a detail, from another drawing. are some, so it's because they don't do, if you were to do mockups of details, mm-hmm. it solves problems. So for me, as a practice, and what we do is we do three-dimensional detail. We don't do detail in 2D. Because in three dimension, you solve a lot of problems.
Oh, yeah.
And that and the fact that we have a set of printers, 3D printers, we print our details and put them together. So we solve the problem before it becomes one. Yeah.
Very, very good process. I always say that everyone who's in architecture should at some point go through, you know, some work in the construction field, actually looking at things coming together.
Yes.
I like that process. All right. So you also dabble in other art forms, as you said. Photography seems to be a very big one for you. I've seen some sculpting. I've seen some, you know, 3D form making. When did all of that start to come on stream?
Boredom. So I'm always in pursuit of things that are fun, and I always want to know how things work. So photography started because of me taking photos of projects. So you go to a project, you may take existing photos, and I had a little Sony CyberShoot camera, and I'm on the train, and I put this phone in my back pocket. But the button, when I go to sit, I guess the pressure from me trying to sit, engage the power button. And it's one of those cameras that the lens extends once the power is on. So the power is on, the lens is extending, it's in my back pocket, and I'm sitting at the same time. So all I heard was this crushing sound. That's it. So the camera at the time, it was, you know, the best thing on the market. 5 megapixels was hottest thing. It was a Sony CyberShot. And I wanted to buy a new camera. But I was like, I don't want to buy back the same camera. So I decided I'm going to go for the professional looking camera instead. And decided to buy, at the time it was, Canon had just started to get into digital cameras. So I decided I was going to buy the digital camera. The only problem was it was $30,000. So I'm like, okay, you know, I'm going to buy the bullet. It's going to give me that professional look. Because I always wanted to have something in a magazine. That was the next thing for me. I want to have a photo in a magazine. So I decided to buy the camera. When I bought the camera, I realized, oh, you need to buy lens for the camera too. So bought that too. And before you know it, a lot of money was spent. So now I have to use the camera. But I wasn't very much of a people person. So all I shot was I used to go to the park every day and take photos of plants and bees and things that didn't talk. Once it didn't talk, I was taking a photo of it. And that's what I did for years. Until one day, a friend of mine asked me to take some photos of her. Well, she was a dancer. And the only reason why I agreed to it is because I knew her. We already had a kind of a relationship of being friends. So there was no strangeness about taking a photo and having to produce something exquisite of a magazine type quality. She didn't really care. She just wanted a photo for the dance. So I did that. Did the post processing because I was pretty good with photo manipulation. And she liked it. So then her friends were like, well, I want one too. And then they liked it too. And that's how the photography thing started.
Okay. And that has really developed into, it seems, something much larger. Is that?
Well, that remember, the goal for me was just to get in a magazine.
Right.
From that time till I actually got into a magazine was maybe 3 years. Three years afterwards, I got into the first magazine. It was a magazine called Blue Magazine, and I got to shoot a 6-page spread for in the video, there's a Lady Gaga has a video called Alejandro, the dancer that's directly behind her. It was the model for that shoot. So we did got the designers to come in. And, you know, from that point on, and it was kind of a successful photography career in that I got the magazine, then I got Vogue Italia, get to do that too. Then I shot for Rock Nation. They had, what's his name? Jahlil Beats, you know, get to shoot him and Grammy winner, Father Goose and Dan Zane from Nickelodeon. So I get to shoot a lot of people. I just don't really brag or talk or even show it. It was just for me to know that I did it.
Yeah.
And the small circle know that I did it. But the public as it stands don't really know. They might see my name on something, but then they have to question really is really me, because I don't really care if it's publicly known or not. So I just leave it the way it is.
So how did you get that first magazine? How did you end up writing that 6-page spread?
First one came about because of the makeup artist. So the makeup artist, because I would always work with any makeup artist, anyone, because at the time I wasn't really charging anyone for photo shoots. I just wanted to shoot. I just wanted to keep making stuff, right? And for me, the main goal was, if you look at my images, one constant you would see is all of the models are black. And that was deliberate, in that being a little bit in the industry, there were just some images you don't see of individuals that were black. You don't see that category of images that had a very polished look to it, that was equivalent, that would be in a magazine, that it was just, you just didn't see it. So I decided I was going to create it, and I was going to push that. So in doing so, I get to work with makeup artists that wanted to try their hands at that. They wanted images that had that look to it, that finished polished look. There was a magazine quality, aka high-end look. Okay. And they wanted that. So I worked with different makeup artists. So one of the makeup artists that I work on, who is a top makeup artist today, brought me on board and recommended me to the designer. And the designer had a conversation. He's like, you know, we're definitely going to use you. And that's how that came about.
Okay, and the rest is history.
The rest is progress.
Progress, all right. So something that I've noticed from your practice, I guess, is that you share your process, both in architecture and photography, in a way that most people probably would not, or at least that I have not seen it. So there's always some, you know, back behind the scene shots of your photography making process, or how you design your buildings, the conceptual relations. What do you think you gain from that, or what's the reason for doing that, you being not a cool person?
Well, it stems from a combination of things. If I were to ask you, for example, have you ever fried chicken before?
Yep.
Yes. No, it's like a no-brainer for some people, because you need oil, you need the chicken, you need the pot. You know all the ingredients you need in order to make fried chicken. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't mean that if you like the way your mom cooks fried chicken, even though you can cook fried chicken, you would prefer her to make the fried chicken, because for some reason, whatever she does, it tastes better, if that's an analogy. So in here is that if I show the process, it allows those who don't know to have a better understanding of what goes into it, so that they can understand. Because the reason why I think we have a lot of the problems that we have as it relates to construction and architecture and in life is the ability to understand. If you cannot understand something, you become ignorant. You are ignorant of that. And your reaction to it would always be based on ignorance. And then you tend to make irrational decision based on your ignorance. But if you're making a rational decision, well, ignorance and rational shouldn't go together. But if you're making a rational decision based on information, that's a sound judgment you're using. Allegedly. So by me putting it out, it allows people to understand, one, it's not a cookie cutter situation. The approach that I take to coming up with a concept and to going through the building and to understand, and that if they have to come and want to require me to do something, this is what you're going to go through. So it's not going to be any. And in Grenada, particularly, well, not just Grenada, in Grenada, the same thing happens in Ghana and Nigeria, which is all places that we've done work also, and Tanzania. It's the same thing. So if you were, I'm going to use Grenada for this example. Mm-hmm. In Grenada, you have different pockets of areas that have quote unquote wealthy individuals whose homes look a particular way. So for me, the only reason I am looking or practicing in Grenada, only and single reason, as soon as that reason is no longer there, I'm out, is I wanted to give the man that has $200,000, $300,000, a home that looks exactly or thereabout, within reason, as the man that has spent $2 million for his house. Because I could not fathom that you can drive from St. George's to St. Andrews, and every house you see is relatively the same thing. Yet, everyone that lives in those houses is an individual with their own unique personality, but yet their homes do not. So the argument could be made that the reason why the country is where it is because nothing changes. If you're not willing to change your home, then you're not willing to change yourself. It's an argument that could be made. It's far-fetched, but there's an argument to be made there. So if there's incremental changes, you know, people, Grenada is a place that people travel for tourism. Tourism is the thing. Mm-hmm. Have you ever been travel any other place, like any European country, for example?
Europe, not so much. Been to Australia.
Okay, Australia is fine.
Yeah.
Right? If you go to Australia, part of the what going to Australia is to see its architecture, because they have good architecture in Australia. Mm-hmm. To see its the Opera House, because that's a staple that most people want to see. Its ports. So there are elements of Australia that you go to see. People travel to Europe to see the architecture, and people come to the Caribbean to go on the beach. But the Caribbean could be a place that you go to look at architecture too. But somebody has to do it. Somebody has to say, you know what, let's put our architecture on the map. Now, the Caribbean doesn't really have a style. The environment kind of dictates what's efficient. So it's a bit of efficiency. But that does not mean you cannot find a way to marry efficiency, the environment, and styles. And come up with something.
I guess that was going to be my next question. What do you see as the Caribbean or even the Grenadian style, or what aesthetic is Grenada particular to us?
Right. Yeah. It's very easy. Bathroom on the left. No, bedroom on the left. Bedroom on the right. Bathroom in the middle. Corridor, kitchen, living room, dining room. That's it. That's a typical home in Grenada. Now, I know where it came from. I know exactly where it came from.
So where do you think that it can go? What direction do you think it should be taking?
I think, well, for me, Grenada does not currently have individuals in leadership position, i.e. government, that are thinking ahead in this department in terms of planners whose sole purpose is to envision Grenada in the next 100 years. Not 50, not 20, next 100 years. So that 100 years from now, you would have made incremental steps to make the country more efficient and better after you're gone. No, they're not thinking like that. They don't have that. So what you're going to have is this little micro changes, incremental changes, that doesn't address the bigger picture. case, give you a small one. Developments in different parts of it. Grenada, again, I don't know of this one. If it's there, I am unaware of it. So I'm just going to make the assumption for now, which I could be wrong. But I don't think Grenada has a somewhat of a mandate of what the width of a road needs to be as it relates to vehicular traffic and pedestrian walkway. That if you're doing any type of development, anything you're doing with roads, to make sure that you maintain this width for roads. So let's say I have a piece of property along of a road. You know, they have various setbacks. I get that. But the road I'm talking about, in that, have some infrastructure in place that this is the width of the road, so that you're not going to have a situation where one person has to pull on the side for the next person to squeeze past, and then you end up in this kind of maneuvering situation where every time you have to pass one vehicle, you have to think about the rest of your life in this moment, right? Or if you're walking on the sidewalk and a vehicle is coming, you have to stop, turn your body sideways, because if you keep forward, your chances are going to get hit.
Yep.
So these are the things, as minuscule and as non-important as it might sound, these are little incremental changes that can make people's lives so much better. So that's that.
And do you, so this is a bit more on the maybe urban planning side of things. Do you do any of that at all? Or are you strictly buildings?
No, well, urban planning, no, I don't do urban planning. In terms of something that I would have to do, there are projects that we were involved in that required us to think about it and be engaged in urban planners. Yes. But in terms of something that I would say I would done in a daily, no.
Okay.
In doing, like, for example, a master plan allows you to think along that line.
Right.
In terms of, urban planning requires, you know, a long-term study in terms of projecting how people's going to move and effects and development and so on. So no. But if it's something that I need to do, I think I've already have some of the grassroots fundamentals in order to do it, but it's not something I would automatically run to go do.
Right. No. And I think it just speaks to, you know, the interoperability of a lot of these different disciplines. You kind of cannot work in a silo. You know, you're developing a building, but you need to have someone who's thinking about how that building then affects, you know, the area around it, the buildings around it, the things that people use, how they interact with it, how they get from one place to another.
Yeah, I mean, there are so much buildings to me, you know, that are developed in Grenada. Like, I remember having a conversation with someone about what the government can do, because I don't think again, I can't speak for the government. I don't know. So I'm speaking a little bit in ignorance there, but the government can do more to incentivize construction architecture in Grenada with some simple steps. One. There are a lot of secondary schools that have technical drawing programs, including TAMCC. And the government have a lot of projects, infrastructure and the school projects and whatever projects that they would be undertaking. Or in what they could do, you would have a design competition. Why not introduce the schools into this design competition? Let the students go. And because they are fresh minds, they're going to think a little bit more crazy in terms of what's possible and whatnot. Get them involved in whichever school or whichever group or whichever individual design is favorable. Pair that individual up with the design firm or the architectural firm in some way, shape or form, so that that student can have a little bit of a kind of a work program situation. That they get to see something that they conceptualize from school can now become something in a reality. It costs absolutely nothing to do that. Just words. There's no cost. There's no implication of any kind. Just instituted, which means every project that the government has, you could include schools in it. Mm-hmm. You know what? We want to redo this road. Let the students go and come up with a way. And it's like a way to get free ideas, but you're getting fresh ideas.
You're speaking to my heart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let them come up with the fresh ideas. You have the design professionals who are there to guide their thoughts to say, well, we can't do this. Their next question is going to be, why? You now need to have a legitimate reason to say, well, we can't do it because this is going to cost too much. But how much is it going to cost? I know you get to put yourself in a position. It's like having a child, a baby, that's inquisitive and asking you questions and force you in a position where you have to tell them. Well, most people that get into the design professional world lose that. They grow up and they lose their childhood, you know, zeal, their passion. They no longer, it's like a task. They lost the fun. Get out. Go do something else. Go retire and pick grapes or cake. I don't know. But, right? But it's like, you know, some people want to hold on because they want to feel relevant. Mm-hmm. But some of you have to say to yourself, and again, it's telling someone that they're no longer useful is the fastest way to get someone to feel like, no, they have to prove that they're useful and they're still relevant. Because nobody wants to feel irrelevant. But at some point in time, you have to come to the realization that you're unable to produce because you're not maintaining what's current. You know, for us in architecture, we have to do continuing education. Every 2 or 3 years, you have to, keep maintaining to make sure that you're current in what's new technologies, new bill of materials, new way of doing things. You know, 5 or 6 years ago, what was I doing with a 3D printer? Now I have 6 3D printers and I'm looking to get more. I print everything I could. Like, even if I don't have use for it, I just print it just because I can. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I would, you know, think of Grenada during COVID. You know what would have happened if during COVID, homes in Grenada had a 3D printer? The things that would have come out of people's houses, nobody would have been bored no more. Because you'd have had students and parents making things for their homes that could, take for example, Jamaica. Jamaica have a robotics program. Jamaica entered into a robotic competition, I think came second or third. Jamaica is pretty much leading the Caribbean in 3D printing in primary schools. Not secondary school, primary schools. And when I look at what Jamaica is producing at 3D printer primary school, because the kids are so inquisitive, they want to make different stuff. During COVID, the big winner during COVID was 3D printers, because people was able to print face shields holder and mask, which I did also, from your home. Every 2 hours, I could produce a mask. I can produce 8 or 9 shields, holders for shields. You can share the file and be able to produce whatever you want. That changes the game and that moves the place forward. You know, take off farmers in Grenada, right? Let's take farmers. Farmer has a 3D printer in his house. He needs an attachment for holes or some attachment he needs to make. Mm-hmm. Maybe he can't physically do it, but get someone who could design the part for him and fabricate the part. In 24 hours, he has the part in his hand and his farm is back up and running. So we can move the thing along, just create the situation where the thinking is, this is what we're going to do.
Remove the bottleneck.
I'm not political in any way, but this is going to sound political. But imagine if the same wanting or the same looking for the right word here.
Desires.
I'll use that. Imagine if the same desire put into tourism and attracting individuals to Grenada. Yes, I understand Grenada tourism is a big part of it. But imagine if that same effort and marketing and resources was put into developing what we just talked about. So the argument could be made, well, those resources are not being put in place, or maybe it's put in place, but it's put in place not at the same rate.
Yeah, same energy.
Correct. So Grenada needs fresh thinkers that are bold thinkers and individuals that's not going to talk about what they're going to do, but do talk about what they did. Don't say you're going to do anything. Say it after you finish the work. Don't ask for permission. Say sorry. That's been my motto. That's always been my motto. I say sorry after. I'm going to do it first. Right? My mom used to make macaroni pie. And I used to love when she make the macaroni pie and she boil the macaroni and put the milk and the cheese before she put it in the microwave. Mm-hmm. I used to like it like that. So I used to eat it. And she used to tell me, don't eat it, because I know if I eat it, she's going to beat me. I'm going to eat it anyway, and I'm going to take the beating because I already get the satisfaction of eating it. Same goes for the bread. When she baked the bread, she used to let the bread cool down. I used to love to eat the bread when it's hot. But if I eat the bread at the hot, she's going to know I eat the bread. So we used to take the bread out the pan, pull it out from the bottom, put the bread back into the pan so it looks pristine. So you're not going to know until you cut it. And by the time it's cut, a lot of time has passed.
Not worth it anymore.
Right. So I always used to just say sorry. I say sorry all the time, but I will do it first. I will get the satisfaction of doing it.
Always grateful. Always.
Because that, let me tell you something. The world we live in is not because of people who ask for permission. Mm-hmm. If Elon Musk was to ask for permission to do the things we do, we wouldn't have Tesla. Right? The world, the people that move the world forward, good or bad, subjective, are the people that did not ask for permission. These are the people that went ahead and decided on their own they're going to risk something. Grenada is not a place of risk because of the generation that's there and the parents, including mine, they're not risk takers. And they prevent you from taking risks by telling you the danger of the risk you're taking. Not guiding you to take the risk, but prevent you because it's safer to not take the risk.
Right.
Oh, you might die. Okay, so what? And then I'm dead. Make another child.
So, all right, Julian, this has been a great conversation. What do you think you see for yourself, if you see anything, in the next 5, 10 years of your career? What's next for Julian?
I have not thought that far in the next 10 years, but I can tell you for 5.
Okay.
10 years, I might be dead. Who knows? But 5 years, in the next 5 years, is to develop a nice portfolio for Grenada. My old boss, the one that gave me the job, mm-hmm. has been behind me for the past 3 or 4 years to make a book. You know, come on, Julian, make an architecture book. And I keep saying, I don't have enough projects in there to do it. Even if I do, I don't feel they're good enough to publish a book. For him, it is. Because for him, I have surpassed in terms of what he would have done in his lifetime. Well, in his life. Lifetime right. is not good yet. But I would have surpassed him in terms of dollar value of projects, in terms of the type of projects, and the scope of the projects in different parts of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And to know that I walk into his office not knowing anything, really. So a lot of what I learned came from his tutelage and being under him, among others, but I'm referring to him in this case, and such a publisher book. And I just don't feel it's enough. So publishing a book is one, which I would dedicate to him, because he's the one that has constantly been behind me to do it. So a publisher book is one. Institute some sort of movement where there's a change in the way people in Grenada particularly look at architecture. I don't know who else is doing it, but I'm going to try. I might fail at it, but okay, so what? That for people to look at it different and change the way construction is done in Grenada, a little bit more transparency, because I hear a lot of the horror stories. I get to hear and see a lot of the practices that I don't agree with in Grenada. And I think that construction and architecture in Grenada should be considered an economic problem. Because if you have 20% of the population engaging in construction, let's say 10% of the population engaging in construction in some way, shape, or form, and 5% of that is going to end up in some sort of financial situation where contractor ran off with money, and then you have litigation with lawyers, and then you're going to tie up the court system, that's an economic problem. Mm-hmm. Then you have a lot of people abroad, now that this COVID thing, who is returning to Grenada. And they're going to be taking their finances from here and bringing it to Grenada. And a lot of people are scared to do so because of the horror stories that comes out of Grenada. Now, I'm not saying that's always the case, but I've heard and seen some things which I don't agree with. Certain practices that happens in Grenada, both high and low, that, you know, a little bit of checks and balances would solve that problem. Mm-hmm. So for me, it's just to educate the masses, which I've already doing through, you know, Facebook and my WhatsApp status, to show. And I'm being transparent. I'm not hiding anything. So you get to see the good, the bad, and the ugly. How much something is costing. You know, a design idea I have that I love and the client don't like it. You get to see it. Mm-hmm. So I'm not filtering anything from anyone. You know, I remember putting up a building in Grenada and showing the exact cost of the house. The contractor called me and told me, take that down. I'm like, no, I'm not taking it down. Because by me saying what the price is means that if someone was to come to him, they're going to say, well, how did you build that house? Cost. And I give you an example. I have a client whose house is built now. The cost of their house, let's just say, was $500,000, right? Mm-hmm. And they have a family member whose house is not as large in terms of square footage, not as detailed in terms of what's in the house, doesn't have the same type of fixtures, but costs $700,000. Huh. So one person has a 3-bedroom and 2 apartments, and the other one has a 2-bedroom house. And the 2-bedroom house, which is smaller, sits on a relatively leveled piece of land, costs more than their house that has considerably more. And you would think it's the other way around.
Right.
So now that family member is trying to figure out how did they spend more money for it than them, than the other family. And it comes down to the contractor who was there managing your project. Did you do checks and balances? I've had potential clients reach out to me and I turned on the project where they had numbers from contractors where a sink was $700 for a sink. Not to install the sink in it. The sink was $700. So I'm like, well, okay, what type of sink is it? It was just a normal, regular stainless steel sink that you could go in the store in Grenada and buy one for like $200. So how did the sink get to $700? But there's nobody there to guide them to say, look, this is an inflated number.
Right.
And they signed off to that. So if there isn't, as I said, the process is not known. If you want to put up a building in Grenada, where do you go to find out what's the procedure? You need a loan. You go to the bank. You say, okay, I want to get a loan. They say you need X, Y, Z, A, B, C. You go to the police. Hey, I want to make a report. What's the procedure? They tell you A, B, C, X, Y, D. You want to get a driver's license? But if you want to build a house, where do you go? Which government facility? So that's where the first place you'll want to go is going to tell you the procedure in building a house. You find it on your own. You get information from someone else. Mm-hmm. And there's no way to know if that information is like a standard. So these are the little micro things that I hope to institute and change, not just for me, but for everyone else. Because I'm not just thinking about me. It benefits everybody equally. Win, lose, or draw.
Win, lose, or draw. Yes. Well, it sounds like there's a lot coming for you from you in Grenada in the years to come.
Well, I mean, I'm trying to juggle Grenada, New York. Well, no, Trinidad has opened up. St. Vincent has opened up. St. Lucia has opened up. The Bahamas has opened up. We're already in Africa. So it's just trying to juggle, the different location without stretching ourselves too thin.
Right. So where's a good place for people who want to keep up with what you're doing to see what Julian Mitchell is up to?
Someone said to me that I should create a blog. I'm not going to do that because I don't have time for that. Okay. The next person said I should create a YouTube channel. I'm not going to do that because it takes away from the, everything happens dynamically with me. Mm-hmm. And it's either you get it or you don't get it. Life is not about always being able to record something and go back and look at it. A memory is something you hold on to. So for the most part, I keep most stuff either on Facebook, every now and then, Instagram, every now and then, but majority of it is on my WhatsApp stats.
Mm. Okay. So
in order to see it, gotta look at my WhatsApp stats.
What are your Facebook and Instagram handles?
My Instagram handle. That's two Instagram handles. One on Instagram, it's JSMD Studio. That one was primarily for photography, but being that I'm not going to be in photography as in depth as I would before, only because I only want to shoot certain things of a particular substance right now. So I am not shooting as much as I would have previously. So that's that. And then you have the architecture related page, where it's everything architecture, and that is gsm.architecture. So that one is exclusively architecture across the board. Either something I had to do with, something I've seen, something I like, but the majority of things are things that have some association to do with me.
Got it.
So that's that. On Facebook, it's my name, Julian Mitchell.
Julian Mitchell.
And on Instagram, well, not my Instagram, on WhatsApp, it's my phone number.
Okay.
So most of the time, people just, which they do, oh, could you add my friend? So they'll just give me a phone number and I'll add the person. I don't know who it is, nor do I care. And just add them so they could learn. A matter of fact, right, I have maybe 20 or 30 individuals who would have reached out to me for architecture services, did not go with me. They went with someone else. Again, I don't have a problem with that. Daily, watch my status daily and query on it for the purpose of solving their issue, even though they didn't hire me, and I don't have no problems with them. One of them, actually, I think maybe after 3 or 4 months into their project and watching my status, stopped their construction because by watching their status, they realized they were going to head into one of the places that, on from the status, I was saying, you know, look out for this type of situation because this is where it could lead. And she was heading in that exact situation. So she stopped her project, you know, seek out some advice. And even though she didn't hire me, I still gave her the information so she could carry out the information. So I'm not to the point where, you know, it's either me or no. There's enough for everybody. There's enough for everybody. You know, I have two hands and but one mouth. So I couldn't put so much things in the mouth of one diet.
It's all about education. All about educating the masses.
And see, if we move together, if we all rise together and we don't leave anybody behind, we all rise together. Yes, they're going to have somebody that's going to left behind, but it's minimal. We're not leaving everybody. So if we could bring everyone forward and we could share the information, all right? And the name of the game is information. Unfortunately, now in the environment we live, information is monetized, right? Because everyone is looking to eat. But at the same time, you could only eat so much.
Amen.
So no one could take away what I know. You can't take away from me. You can't take away my experiences. That's mine. Forever. So I could share what I want to share when I want to share it. And I could hold on to what I want to hold on to. What makes me special compared to someone else is the sum of my existence, which nobody could take away. So why am I worried?
Well put. Well put. All right, Julian, thank you so much for speaking with us today, for joining us and sharing your pathway.
It was a pleasure.
It has been a pleasure. And for those listening, I will add the things that we talked about and your links to your social media in the show notes or description so that they can follow along and see what it is that you're getting into.
Not a problem. As I said, if anybody got questions, I don't bite. You know, I don't bite. You can ask the question. There's no charge for asking a question. Questions is free. You know, I have a very heavy voice. It's very soft. I'm like a little kitten that trying to roar like a lion. And so.
And what's the best place for someone who has a question to reach you?
They can reach me, they can call me if they want to. Number is 917-721-0856. That's one. My number is also on my Facebook page. It's also on my Instagram page. So it's right there. They can email me if they wish. You can email me at jsmdstudio@gmail. Or you can message me on Facebook. You can message me on Instagram. They could tell you to tell me.
All right. He's an open book. He's an open book, everyone.
I'm open. I answer everyone's question. It's a question. You're not asking me for a kidney. It's a different conversation.
All right. It's been great. It's been a great discussion. Thank you so much. And we will talk soon.
All right. Have a good one.
And to the listeners, thank you for joining us on today's Pathway.